I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Facebook has taken steps to rid the platform of so-called fake news that was a problem in the 2016 presidential election by removing false accounts and the distribution of false posts, among other actions. Mexico has a presidential election this Sunday, and that is a test for Facebook, whose global reach is enormous. They have enlisted the help of security teams, artificial intelligence, and the public, but will that be enough? Joining us is Elizabeth Dwoskin, who covers Silicon Valley for The Washington Post, to talk about Mexico's election. Also, her story today about the upcoming midterms in this country and what tech companies are doing. Elizabeth Dwoskin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what are the safeguards that have been put in place in Mexico in particular?
Well, first, I think it's important to understand the perspective of what Facebook has done globally, because they always have this tension of this is a company with over 2 billion users, probably one of the most users of almost any company in the world besides Google. And they have to build things that aren't just for Mexico or for Brazil or for Kenya. They have to build things that work for the world, because, as they told me, they're actively monitoring 50 elections in 2018. That's basically an election a week. In Mexico, they started fact-checking in March. And as I wrote in the story, they have about, until recently, they had about a dozen fact-checkers. For a country where 84 million people are on Facebook, they call it their first Facebook election, because back in 2012, during their last presidential election, very few people were on Facebook. So they're having kind of, a lot of the world too, is having this version of the first social media election that maybe the U.S. had a few years ago.
Well, a dozen fact checkers clearly is not enough. You also write about the fact that they have enlisted the help of the public, people that use Facebook, to at least be part of a team to alert Facebook about suspicious posts. How effective is that?
Yeah, so anyone on Facebook can do this. You can do this too if you're a listener. If you spot something on Facebook that you think is problematic, whether it's pornography or whether it's false news, there's actually a tab on the right of your Facebook post where you can actually flag it to Facebook and say, hey, I think this is false. Facebook has had the pornography tab for a long time. Now it's added false news, and they have it in Mexico too. So people can tell Facebook, hey, I think this is false, Facebook, look into it. The problem is, of course, is that all these signals are not credible. As one executive told me, my job would be so easy if things that were actually false were things that people flagged as false. So that's not the case. People often just flag things that they disagree with. So what you have is a situation where, in the United States, Facebook started fact-checking about a year and 9 months ago, shortly after the 2016 election. And they hired what now is 5 independent fact-checking groups, journalistic groups that you've heard of. And those groups get special software that Facebook has built for fact-checkers. This is about scaling, something they feel they can build for the whole world. And that software lets fact-checkers basically take a story and input it. So let's say a lot of people see that it's false. Facebook systems will send them a story and say, hey, checkers, don't look at story A, look at story B. And then once the checkers find problematic stories, they put them into the software. So what's interesting to see is that Mexico has this historic election coming up this week, and it's one of the countries with the largest number of Facebook users outside of the United States. It's in the top 5. So it's a huge market for them. And remember that the U.S. just overall is less, around 10% of their user base. So really they have to make products for developing world, complicated democracies, weak democracies, countries that aren't democracies. And what they do is they start this fact-checking program very late, just 3 months before their own historic election. And the fact-checkers, the technology works with artificial intelligence, and it understands what stories are bubbling up in the network and starts sending it to fact-checkers. But in Mexico, the system is very nascent, very early, because artificial intelligence actually takes a while to rev up. It takes a while to learn the system, learn behaviors. And so when I was down there, what was interesting was that the checkers told me that almost all the stories they get, aren't from Facebook's artificial intelligence, which it often touts, but just from everyday people who have heard that there are fact checkers in the country through news articles or social media or whatnot, and just say, hey, you know, my cousin sent me this story, or I saw this story on Facebook. It seems a little weird. Is it true? And there's a whole shadowy economy behind these fake groups and these disinformation groups as well. And the groups, it's a different dynamic than the United States.
In fact, you say a lot of the disinformation is not coming from Russian trolls or outsiders. It's really domestic disinformation. Does that make it harder for Facebook to police this stuff?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about reporting the story was that Facebook told me that their biggest growth category for disinformation operations, which are, you know, anything from putting in posts that are false in a coordinated way to, you know, usually ideologically motivated or you're being paid for by a government. The biggest category, you know, what Russia did, but in the United States, we paid all this attention to foreign interference. Facebook says that the biggest growth category for disinformation, almost not surprisingly, in countries around the world is domestic interference.
Yeah.
And you can think of that as that's just democracy. People putting out fake news, people putting out sensational posts about their own country. I mean, a lot of what the Russians took, the content that they took and put on Facebook was posted by everyday Americans. But it's not just that. It's not just people, you know, saying what they want to say, being angry, being passionate, everything people do on social media. It's also about coordinated efforts like the IRA, which was the Russian troll factory. And you have many countries where the political organizations in the country, the political establishment, have their own disinformation groups, their own troll factories. That's what experts talked about a lot in Mexico. So you have groups that are creating fake accounts. You have groups that are purposely seeding fights with people, purposely supporting one person over the other. And these people are often paid to do it. Now you're saying, well, how is that different from political consultancy?
Sure.
Okay, this is just your regular social media consultancy.
Exactly.
But, well, one thing is that they're breaking Facebook's rules. You're not allowed to, one person isn't allowed on Facebook to maintain 100 different accounts that aren't their name. Facebook, you can on Twitter, which makes it even more complicated. But Facebook has a real name policy. So that's one thing. Two, they've created this, what I call like a Sisyphean bar, because they have this rule that you can't put up content that's, quote, inauthentic. So you have to really feel and believe what you're posting. If it's false news, if it's sensational, like Facebook is okay with it as long as you believe in it yourself. Hmm. If you're doing it because it's, quote, inauthentic, then that breaks their rules too. And I ask in the story, what does it mean for content to be inauthentic? If I'm a paid political consultant, you know, I might believe in the cause. That's why I took that job. So I'm putting this out. What's inauthentic about that? I'm coordinating with others, but I might be ideologically motivated to do so. So I think this inauthentic term is really interesting to me, because you have to think, on one level, it's marketing. Facebook is trying to take a really messy world and boil it down into what they prohibit and what they permit. But remember, the people who work for Facebook, who are in charge of taking this content down on the minute-by-minute, second-by-second basis around the world, are thousands, 15,000 right now, content moderators that are located in call centers overseas. Those are the people that are actually in charge. And those people literally have a rule book where they have to look at this content every day and decide, does it break the rules or not? Is it inauthentic or not? And so a lot of the stuff you're looking and you're saying, how? And that's what was so interesting about being in Mexico, because you see that all the experts are saying, you know, look at all this fake news that we have. It's flooding our ecosystem. And some of the stuff, by the way, is really ugly. I would say some of it's way uglier than you would see in the United States, like a video of a man who was burned alive, and the video was doctored to look like the people who were endorsing the killing of this murder.
Wow.
Were actually supporters of the current front runner.
Wow.
So it was a doctored video saying that they were burning a man alive, and that was going all around on WhatsApp, which is owned by Facebook. And, you know, what's fascinating to see is that how does Facebook know who's behind these groups, and yet they've set themselves up to do so. So I spent a while actually trying to find out who's behind these groups, and I found out some really interesting things.
Well, you know what? Only because we have a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, and this is fascinating and really important as well. But it seems as if Facebook, based on what you are saying, Elizabeth, has set up an impossible standard for themselves. Maybe necessary, but impossible.
That's my thesis in the story, is that Facebook has an operation that is a security operation that is in the trenches, and Facebook has a marketing operation that likes to tell its story about itself. Right. And the story they want to tell about themselves is that they're going to keep elections honest around the world. And then the reality is what I went to see, and it's completely different. So sometimes you wonder, well, maybe if they didn't have those aspirations, then, you know, people would be less upset at them. It's probably not true, because people would still call them out. One of the most interesting things, by the way, about being in Mexico is that people are upset about fake news there because the debates in the United States mirror onto their country because they're so close to the U.S. Fake news is a big thing there. Russia is a big thing there, and they don't even have Russian intervention, likely. I could be wrong about that, but so far they haven't seen evidence. But what's really fascinating about it is that, you know, their context, which is so different, but they're not holding Facebook to the standards that Americans do. I think Americans really expect for elections to be honest. Mm-hmm. They expect that everyone should clean this up, that tech companies should be part of that, the civic democracy. In Mexico, people are still in the phase where I would call it like they're at the top of the hype cycle for social media. They're just really happy that they can express. And the fact is their mainstream media is corrupt. So they don't have the same expectations that social media should be honest and should reflect the debate in some way that's full of integrity that I think Americans do. Well, so that was fascinating.
Yes, indeed. And let me ask you about today's story. The title, Tech Didn't Spot Russian Interference During the Last Election. Now it's asking law enforcement for help. Where do things stand in a minute or less? Sorry about that. Where do things, though, stand in this country and what Facebook and other tech companies are doing to make sure we don't have a repeat of 2016?
Well, as I said, they're pouring immense resources into it. From artificial intelligence to over 20,000 content moderators by the end of this year, but and new software tools. But what I learned is, you know, they disclosed to me actually that they have found no evidence yet this year of Russian involvement in the midterms, and that's the IRA and also the GRU, Russia's spy agency, and other potential troll factories. So they're looking and looking. They have not found anything, is what they told me on the record so far. Our scoop, which is the story we've been working on for several days, is about the secret meeting that was convened last month at Facebook with all the tech companies, where they just basically spoke to the FBI and DHS about what they were doing and agreed to have points of contact in case emergencies came about. Now, that sounds to you like you're like thinking, wow, shouldn't they have this? I mean, this is a huge disruption of our election last time around, 2 years ago. We're 2 years later. They're just having this meeting now. And that really shows that there hasn't been dialogue between the technology companies and law enforcement on this issue still. It's just starting now, a few months before the midterms.
Well, you know, Elizabeth, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Elizabeth Dwoskin covers Silicon Valley for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take a short break and then talk about voting machines in America. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we were just talking about what Facebook is doing to police trolls using their platform to subvert elections. And what about voting machines? Russian hackers tried to tamper with the voting machines systems in 21 states during the 2016 presidential campaign, including Pennsylvania's, I should add. The U.S. Senate is debating the Secure Elections Act and has called for $380 million to help states upgrade their systems. But is that enough? The Brennan Center did an audit of the country's voting machines and found that many are old and vulnerable to attack and don't have a paper trail in case there are problems. We asked Lawrence Norden to join us, Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Lawrence, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So has anything been done since the 2016 election to secure our voting machines in this country?
Yes, there has been a fair amount that happens, and I want to make a slight correction to something that you mentioned that I think has caused a little bit of confusion in the public about security of voting systems. When we talk about election systems and the fact that they were targeted by the Russians, we're talking about a vast system that includes more than just the machines that we're voting on. It includes the registration databases that list voters. It includes election websites. It includes potentially election night reporting, which is, you know, where you can look on the website to see how totals are coming in. As far as we know, we have no evidence of an actual attack on the machines themselves, the things that we vote on and that count those votes. There was a lot of targeting of registration systems, which is where voters were listed, and in fact, in Illinois, we know the database was breached. We certainly have to do more to protect our voting machines, but I want to make clear that so far there's no evidence that the machines that we vote on were attacked. In terms of what we've done since 2016, Congress allocated about $380 million in March to the states to increase security, and we can talk about all the things that states have been doing with that money. We haven't done as much as we should, I think, to secure the machines themselves. So we do have a lot of really old machines in the United States, and most troubling to security experts, we have in 13 states, including Pennsylvania, machines where there's no paper record. So if there was a successful attack against those machines, it could be very difficult to spot that attack and then to be able to recover from it.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things that you mentioned there. In terms of voting machines themselves, and we've done several shows about this, and I appreciate the distinction between voting machines and our voting system. Are machines, though, vulnerable to any kind of cyber attack? My understanding is that they are essentially a closed system and not connected to the Internet. Do I have that right or wrong?
So hopefully in most cases they are not connected to the Internet. They certainly shouldn't be, and everybody that works in election security has warned against that. But that doesn't mean that there necessarily is no danger from a cyber attack. And, you know, to understand that, just think about the fact that we had computer viruses before we had an Internet. All of these systems have what we call removable memory devices, which is essentially thumb drives that go into the computer, the voting machine, and count votes and display the ballot. If somebody gets access to those disks, essentially, and there are many possible ways that could happen, then potentially they could infect machines. And of course, if you get physical access to a machine, that's another possible way. So there are several ways, and security experts have shown this. That doesn't mean there isn't anything we can do to protect them. There's lots we can do, but it's a vulnerability we have to take seriously.
Is $380 million for the 50 states, is that enough money?
No.
You know, what would be?
Well, you know, it's very hard to pin down a number because this is not something where you're done. Election system security, just the way we upgrade in the offices that we work on, IT security all the time. We need to do that with elections, too. I will say another $300 million would be very helpful. Verified Voting, another organization that we work with, broke down what each state will get from the $380 million that was already offered. And it's not nearly enough, for instance, to replace the paperless systems that security experts say are, you know, one of the first things that we should be doing in the United States. So I think, you know, another $300, $400 million would certainly be very helpful, but I think we can't think of this as we'll just throw one pot of money at it and we'll be done. I think we have to start changing the way we're thinking about election system security in the United States and realize that it needs to be a consistent investment.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Larry Norden. He's deputy director of the Brennan Center Democracy Program. And we are talking about how we vote in this country, talking about security, voting machines, but also our voting system. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. One of the audits from the Brennan Center found that many states are using voting machines that are at least 10 years old, and some of them are not even made anymore. They're no longer manufactured. Mm-hmm. That's in 43 states. So what's wrong with an old voting machine?
Well, particularly if they're not manufactured, a big problem, and we're seeing this around the country, is eventually it becomes impossible to keep them running. So that's a really big problem. So we actually had election officials telling us that they didn't know how they were going to have enough machines for the 2020 election, which is very worrying just from a reliability point of view. Obviously, if you don't have enough machines, you get long lines, you lose voter confidence. But there are security issues associated with this as well. First of all, disproportionately, those old machines are paperless. That means you don't have a paper record that you can use to check to make sure that there wasn't some kind of a virus or bug in the machine. But in addition, these systems don't get security patches because there's no manufacturer anymore. They're running on outdated software, which, you know, was developed before the most advanced cyber attacks that we have today. For all of these reasons, it's probably not a good idea to be using such old machines.
What does a machine cost? What would a modern machine with a paper trail, what would that cost?
The machine itself shouldn't cost all that much. Generally, around $4,000 or $5,000for each machine. But you know, if you're talking about a state like Pennsylvania, that adds up to $40-50 million, at least. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, because you are using thousands of machines in each state.
How much does the fact that we have this more dispersed, decentralized way of voting, I mean, essentially run by the 50 different states, does that create unintended consequences of problems, and perhaps some states are more advanced than others, for instance?
Yeah, a lot of people say that there's an advantage to having such a decentralized system in that, you know, it's not like we're programming all our voting machines in one place and you just have to get to that one place and you can change everybody's votes. But because the system is so decentralized, there's something like 10,000 election jurisdictions in the United States. It's very hard to make sure. There's that expression, you're only as strong as your weakest link, that your weakest link isn't weak, frankly. You've got lots of counties where you don't have any IT professionals, security professionals working in their offices. You know, there are going to be counties and states that don't have the money to replace old insecure equipment. So it's definitely a problem, and it's a reason that we need congressional action on this. Well, I want to make one quick point, which is, you know, we're throwing around numbers like $300, $400 million. I don't mean to make light of that and say that's nothing, but we really are talking about defending our country. And if you look at what we spend on defense, you know, that's essentially the cost of an Air Force jet. So we should be able to find that money to defend our democracy.
Let me quote something from Matt Masterson. He coordinates DHS's election security efforts as a senior cybersecurity advisor. He says, to me, the number one threat is around public confidence in the process, how we are talking about this. I'm quoting here, how we are educating the public so they have confidence in the process and will show up and vote, because the best response to any attempt to undermine confidence in the process is to vote. Do you think the public is suspicious that when they go to the polls, that vote will not count?
Well, I think Matt is right that confidence is certainly a very important issue. And there's no question that if you look at the goals of the Russians in the 2016 election, or actually it's not just the United States where they've targeted elections around the world, one of their goals is a primary goal, it's undermine confidence. And so we shouldn't let them win, and we should go vote, but we should also be doing everything we can to secure systems. And I think one of the things that could really undermine confidence is if there is a successful attack against our systems and we don't recover from it. Obviously, that's the worst kind of attack we could have on confidence. I think right now, you know, if you look at this, the 2016 election so far, the primaries, people are very energized. People are going out to vote, and I think we should continue to do it. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to be able to recover from an attack if there is one. And there are lots of people certainly working on that today.
Do you think the U.S. has sent a strong enough message to Russia about the threat to our election system? Certainly, we have a president who denies that Russia interfered in the 2016 election at all, but there are many people who, even within the administration, who disagree with him on that. How could, if it's Russia, looks like it was Russia, how should they be punished?
Well, that's a hard question. I don't know if you're going to there certainly should be a reaction, and we're getting outside my area of expertise in terms of it should be a red line that we should not allow anybody to cross in terms of interfering with our elections. What that punishment should be, I'm not so sure. But I will say I am concerned that the lack of a strong reaction, in some ways could open a Pandora's box. This last election, it was clearly the Russians. I think a lot of people thought nobody would ever cross that line against a power like the United States. Now that it's happened, it doesn't have to be the Russians next time. So we should have a strong reaction against any foreign power or anybody that we know that interferes against the election. At the end of the day, we're living in a world where cyber attacks are very common, are going to become more common, not just against elections, everywhere. And the key for me and the thing that I work on and study is to make sure that we can detect things when they happen and we can recover so that even if there is a successful attack, and we have to assume at some point there will be, that we see it, we recover from it, everybody that goes to vote will be able to vote, and their votes, and at the end of the day, it may take some time, but we'll be able to count them.
Well, I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. It does feel, though, a kind of a cat and mouse game about trying to stay ahead of the hackers or people that have evil or bad intent. Do we have the kind of skills and technology to be able to stay ahead of all of this?
We do. I mean, look, this is a reality, not just, as I said, not just in elections, but in the world in general. And the U.S. has the advantage of having a lot of the greatest minds in technology within our borders. And more importantly, I think election officials and security experts have spent a lot of time thinking about what happens if there is a breach. What do we need to do to make sure that votes aren't affected, that at the end of the day we can count every vote. And there are some simple solutions, you know, having a paper record for every vote so that we can go back to that if there's a problem, doing post-election audits so that we're checking that paper and making sure that there wasn't a problem with the machines, having backups every day of registration systems so that if there is a problem we can go back later and reconstruct registration rolls. Having things that are called provisional ballots so that if somebody messes with the rolls or the data registration databases or electronic poll books, which are computers that list people when you come in to vote, that they can vote on something and we can count it later. Like, all of those things, for the most part, exist in the country already, and where they don't, right, we should make sure that they're in place.
Well, I'm thinking about the way most of us bank these days. I mean, is that a model that we can apply to how we vote?
So in some cases, we can use lessons from fields like banking, but I would say there are two important differences. One is we don't spend nearly as much money as financial institutions do on security for
That's
elections.
True.
And the second, of course, is that banking, in some ways, is a public thing. You know what money you should have in your bank account, and you can look at it and you can confirm. We can't really do that with voting. The ballot is secret, and there are lots of problems with public voting. We've decided in this country that's not what we want. And if you can't make that public, it becomes, the security issue is more difficult. If your bank account is hacked into, you can report it to the bank. You won't know if your vote has been hacked into.
Is this
so we need other things.
We need other things as well. Is 90% security, is that something we should go for, or 100%, or where are we, do you think, today?
We still have a lot of work to do on security and investing in our infrastructure. I think we should certainly be at 100% making sure that we can detect and recover from problems. So we may not ever be at 100% about for being able to prevent somebody from breaching the system. But we should have systems that are transparent enough that we can detect problems. And that, again, that's a little bit easier on something like registration, which is public. On voting, that means having paper records and checking them. And then that we can recover if there's a problem. We have some way of saying, yes, there was a breach, but at the end of the day, we're going to make sure everybody can vote, and we're going to count those votes.
Almost out of time here. Any reason to bring back the paper ballot?
Yes.
Yes. I wasn't sure what you were going to say there, Larry. No, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. We can count those paper ballots. It's with computers. That's what we do in a lot of the country. Mm-hmm. But in most of the country now, we're filling out our votes on a paper ballot, and that is being read by a scanner. And I think that's the way to go generally. And then the question is, are we checking? And that we have some work to do around the country, but that's easy enough. So I think that's the direction we're moving in.
And the idea of checking is an audit, right?
That's right. It's an audit after the election to make sure that we can trust the results. And that should be a public thing. We should all see it.
Oh, we should all be able to have access to the audit so that we can feel secure about our vote?
Absolutely. That at the end of the day, transparency, disclosure, sunlight is the best way to prevent any of these things from being successful.
On that note, Lawrence Norden, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And he is the deputy director of the Brennan Center Democracy Program. And speaking of audits and voting, we have the Auditor General of Pennsylvania waiting in the wings, Eugene DePasquale. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, Pennsylvania is one of the states that Russian hackers targeted during the 2016 presidential election, and the state's Auditor General, Eugene DePasquale, has called for an audit of the state's voting systems in response. We asked him to join us to talk about the goal of the audit, voting integrity, and his call for open primaries in Pennsylvania. 750,000 voters, almost 10% of the voting population, are unaffiliated, neither Republican nor Democrat, and cannot vote in the primary. Eugene DePasquale, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me, Marty. Always a pleasure.
Nice to have you with us. So let me just give out the phone number and ways that our listeners can join us, especially about this open primary idea of yours. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And if you favor an open primary system in Pennsylvania. Let me ask you about a couple of voting things before we get to that. As I mentioned in my intro, Pennsylvania, one of the 21 states that Russians tried to hack during the 2016 presidential election. Were they able to penetrate any part of Pennsylvania's voting systems?
We are right now under the impression that the answer to that is no, but one of the things that we're going to find out in the audit is if that answer that we're getting right now is accurate. But according to Homeland Security and their own Pennsylvania Department of State, they are under the belief that the answer is no, but I've got to keep an open mind on that as we go through the audit. Obviously, we know they tried to do it. That is certainly enough of a warning sign, and we know that at least you have to literally just follow the news to realize they're going to keep trying this. That's why we've got to keep trying to improve our election security.
When will you know? And when you know, will you share that with the rest of us?
Absolutely. We will. When the audit is done, we'll certainly be more than public with that for a press conference, and then more than happy to come on your show and talk about the results in even greater detail. And certainly, you know, if you want to take calls as well, more than happy to do that. And also, we want to make sure that we are done in time, so any recommended changes that I'm going to have can be done in time for the 2020 presidential election.
And let me pick up on something our second guest said from the Brennan Center, is that in Pennsylvania, there are a lot of old voting machines. Is that a problem? Do you see that as a problem for voters in the Commonwealth?
Well, there's both a strength and a weakness in how Pennsylvania right now does its elections. Right now, we do have a voter database that is statewide, but we also have our elections are really 67 county elections. Right. So some of those are paper ballots, Some of those are older machines. Some of the newer machines are not connected to the internet, but they run on a card system. So we are going to be having a discussion with county election officials as well as to what needs to be done to make that system secure for all of Pennsylvania. So it's one thing to say that we have some places where it might be easy to hack, some places where it may actually be impossible because it's paper ballots. So that's where, again, we're going to have this, you know, discussion during the audit process with our election officials, because I do think it's important that every single voter feel that their vote is secure.
Is that an argument for one size fits all?
I would say it's certainly, in my view, an argument for at least two things. One is either going to paper ballots or at least some type of paper receipt. I think we've got to at least move towards one of those two, and we've got to absolutely be ironclad that no machine can be hooked up to the internet.
When you were a member of the Harrisburg legislature, you introduced legislation to have open primaries. You're now the Auditor General, and you have doubled down on that with a press release. Yeah. Why do we need open primaries in Pennsylvania?
I think empowering more people that are eligible voters to have access to the ballot is important for our democracy. I think if you just look at voter registration trends, the growth is not so much in the Republican or Democratic parties. And look, I'm a Democrat and a proud Democrat, but it is in independents. I think particularly younger voters are feeling disenchanted with both major parties right now. I do think that if we gave them more of a say in the primary, we can get more people involved in our democracy. They would have to, and the way I promote this is you couldn't vote for, say, the Republican primary for governor and the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. You'd have to declare which party you are on the day of the primary. You'd have to be a registered independent, not with another third party. You'd have to be a non-affiliated registered voter, and you can declare either Democrat or Republican on primary day, and that would give more people access to having a say in the nominees. And this happens in the majority of the rest of the country. And my evidence is that it only helps strengthen our democracy.
I believe there's something like 750,000, so a quarter of a million voters in Pennsylvania who are registered independent. Do I have that right?
That is a ballpark. Obviously, it changes, fluctuates a little bit by the week, but that is the ballpark number, which means there's three quarters of the electorate that basically has no say on primary elections. And there's another part to this, and that is our judicial elections, particularly county and district magistrate, people and school board, people are allowed to cross out Democrat and Republican. But if you are a non-affiliated voter, again, we're freezing them out of that process as well. And just by the fact that you can cross out for judge and school board, we're declaring that those are, in a sense, nonpartisan elections. And still, if you're a non-affiliated voter, we're freezing them out as well. That's got to change.
I looked up this morning the turnout for the primary just a couple of months ago in Pennsylvania. For the primary was 18% across the state.
It's terrible. And when we don't have people participating in our democracy, it weakens our democracy.
But I wonder whether, and we know, gerrymandering is a hot topic here in Pennsylvania. We also know that this is a state that's not particularly welcoming to third-party candidates. We have no excuse, or we have difficulties voting. I mean, if you're out of state or whatever, you have to sort of figure all that stuff out. It seems that even beyond this open primary, we make it really hard for people in Pennsylvania to vote.
Yeah, look, I do think that there is an across-the-board issue with Pennsylvania that is it's certainly, I think, an accurate statement to say it goes beyond the open primaries. I think we've got to do a better job of making this more accessible. I support, same-day registration. I think that certainly has an impact on it. When I was in the legislature, I also introduced a bill creating a nonpartisan Iowa-like redistricting commission, that the mission of the redistricting commission would be to draw competitive races, not to protect incumbents. I think all of that has an impact. Oregon has gone to all mail-in ballots. Their voter participation rate has gone through the roof since they did that. I think we should at least have no excuse absentee ballots. So I think doing a lot of things to make it more accessible for voters to participate in our democracy is something that all of us should strive for. Unfortunately, and I think, there's sometimes an unfortunate side of this, that incumbents in the legislature like to have a system that is beneficial to incumbents. I just don't have that view. I think that we should let the voters decide. I always say the voters should pick their politicians, not the politicians picking their voters.
That's Pennsylvania Auditor General Eugene DePasquale joining us on Radio Times to talk about his idea, his call for open primaries in Pennsylvania. We've also been talking about an audit of the voting machines or the voting systems in the state as well. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. It seems like there is, though, some interest in the legislature on this open primary idea. Do you think that the time is right for that?
I do. I want to commend Senator Scarnati for coming out with at least in support of that. He's the Republican leader of the Senate. I haven't spoken to the governor directly about it, but I just know, enough about him that I think he certainly would be open-minded to it. I do think part of this is people are seeing it's a way to also try to get more moderates involved in the system as well. I think there certainly is a feeling that sometimes the way the primaries right now are going, that you sometimes get, people look at Donald Trump winning the nomination and think, look, you on one hand, he won it fair and square. On the other hand, he was able to win the nomination because there was, sort of 10 Republicans competing in the primary, and he had to go. He kept going further and further to the right to win that nomination. He maybe had the states were more, you take like a state like New Hampshire and some of these other states where more moderates were able to have a say in it. Maybe it could have, you could have had someone like a John Kasich be the nominee, and we would have had certainly maybe not some of the craziness that's coming out of the White House right now.
But is there any evidence that unaffiliated voters are moderate voters?
Anecdotal and talking to some of these other states. So it's anecdotal. There's no hard data, but also some evidence to this. So, and I'll go and sort of who shows up. What tends to happen is for non-affiliated voters is they tend to be more lean left or lean right. So the idea that somebody's going to come in and try to, take over someone else's primary is really just nonsense. What tends to happen is left-leaning non-affiliated voters tend to vote in the Democratic primary, and right-leaning non-affiliated voters tend to vote in the Republican primary. But they do tend to be a more moderate, but they're more independent in their thinking.
What about Philadelphia, which is, a Democratic stronghold? It's been decades since a Republican won, for instance, was the mayor of Philadelphia. How do you think involving more moderates, especially in the primary process, would affect a one-party town like Philadelphia?
Well, and you certainly have a lot of counties in Pennsylvania that are certainly one party the other way, Republican. If you are an unaffiliated voter in some of these areas, it maybe give you more of a say in the primary. Again, the general election, some of our more conservative counties in the central part of the state, you're probably going to have a Republican winning. And certainly in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and some of your other larger metropolitan areas, you're more than likely to have a Democrat winning. But it would give some other people a say in the primary process.
I'm curious about whether by doing this you make the primary more like the general election. And I know that the parties feel as if that primaries are really about parties and party loyalty. What is your answer to that?
Well, to me, it comes down to if you're giving more people a say in our democracy, I view that as healthy. Mm-hmm. And certainly, look, as politicians would be campaigning in a new environment, you have to maybe adjust some campaign tactics, but you're giving more people a say in the democracy, and that can only be healthy.
There are other states. California is a good example of where everyone is competing against everybody else, and the top two winners then compete in the general election. You could have two Democrats running against each other or two Republicans running against each other. Would this be a good idea in Pennsylvania?
I prefer having it where you'd at least have a contrast in the general election between, a Republican and Democrat. And certainly you'd have, and I've even supported where it's easier for third-party nominees to get on the ballot for the general election. I am more preference for that, but allowing more people say in the primary process is my preference.
Just because you feel like that's where people get winnowed out?
Yeah, I think you winnow out, so then you have, you do have a competing ideas In the general election, you know, left versus right, and maybe even a centrist independent, or even obviously you could have people, you know, more liberal, more conservative running on third party ballots as well. But I think then it gets more people focused on the contrast.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just picking up, do you think, I mean, yes, some people in the legislature, some important people are picking up on this idea. What would it take to create open primaries in Pennsylvania?
Mechanically, it would take new legislation that would be signed by the governor. I do think it's going to take, politically, it's going to take more independents and third-party voters and even people in both the Democratic and Republican parties, actual voters, to start making their voice heard to legislators. That's what it's going to take.
You mean picking up the phone and saying, I need to be able to vote in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, and say, look, I think it's a pretty clear message. The taxpayers are paying for the primary, but not all the taxpayers get to participate. That needs to change.
And do you think our governor is interested in something like this?
I don't want to speak for him, but my instinct would be that this would be something he'd be open-minded to. But I don't want to speak for him on it. It's just an instinct I have.
And if we've got, say, a quarter of a million or maybe even more Pennsylvanians who are not registered either as Republican and Democrat, what does that, though, tell us about our political system and especially the two mainstream parties?
Well, I would say, if nothing else, and I am certainly the furthest thing from a supporter of him, but the idea that Donald Trump even came close to winning, let alone winning the White House, should have been a wake-up signal to both mainstream political parties, because I still don't really view him as a Republican. I think he's out for himself. But I view that as the wake-up call that both parties, there is a growing frustration with.
Do you think that the system, especially in Pennsylvania, though, keeps out people who really want to come in and mess things up and make a difference in Harrisburg?
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd view it as messing up. Maybe shake it up might be a better way to phrase it. But I do think our current system makes it very challenging for outsiders, no question about it.
Do you want to be governor of Pennsylvania?
Right now, there is 2.5 years left on my term. Looking forward to doing that. And then when that time is over, I will certainly assess the political landscape to see if that's the right opportunity for me. But I'm certainly fine.
I'm almost afraid we're gonna lose you here. Going back to, I think we just lost him. I heard that little very familiar sound of losing our guest mid-interview. Well, that's it. And that was Pennsylvania Auditor General Eugene DePasquale talking about a couple of things, including an audit of the state election system, voting systems, also his call for open primaries in Pennsylvania. We also talked with the Brennan Center about voting machines, and we also talked about Facebook and the challenges of policing Facebook and social media when it comes to elections around the world and here in the United States. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.